I'd like now to welcome David Eagleman. He's a neuroscientist, author, and director of the Laboratory for Perception and Action at Baylor College of Medicine, where he also directs the Initiative on Neuroscience and Law. He will be in Santa Fe on Tuesday, the 4th of June at 7:30 in the evening, giving a talk called The Brain and the Law, How Neuroscience Will Shift Blameworthiness. It's at the James A. Little Theater, and it's sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So some of the questions that you are asking in neuroscience and law are connected to very old debates, like to what extent people have free will, when are they responsible and not responsible for their actions. How do studies of the brain shed new light on these questions?
I think the main thing that emerges is that brains are very different from one another, and this is because brains come about as a result of the genes you come to the table with, mixed with all of the experiences you ever have, starting in your mother's womb, what she's smoking and drinking, and then the neighborhood you're born into, the culture you're born into, every experience you have. These things send brains off on very different developmental trajectories. And the end result is that brains are very different from one another. Brains are like fingerprints in the sense that everybody's got one, but they're quite different. And if you just look around room at the variability in the faces in a room, you would find that much variability in brains as well. The problem is our legal system imagines that all brains are the same. And that's a very charitable assumption, but it's demonstrably false. And the problem that results from it is that we treat incarceration as a one-size-fits-all solution. So America has the number one incarceration rate of any nation on the globe. We put a higher percentage of our population behind bars than anybody. And that has very low utility. It has very high cost, and it doesn't solve the problem. And so what I've been advocating for is an evidence-based legal system that, instead of imagining that all brains are the same in terms of capacities to simulate possible futures and evaluate them, decision-making, risk aversion, and so on, instead of pretending everything is the same, to have a more tailored, customized system. And there are very easy steps to get there right away. Many jurisdictions have peeled off separate courts from the main court system. For example, mental health courts, where there are people there with expertise on mental illness, and they know what's available in terms of early detection, hopes for rehabilitation, and so on. Separate juvenile courts, separate drug courts. A big part of the reason that our prison population has quadrupled since 1980 is the war on drugs, which is totally unwinnable because, you know, we're attacking drug supply, and that will never solve the problem because when you attack supply in one place, it comes up somewhere else. But if you want to address the problem, addressing drug demand is the key because that is the brain of the addict, and we understand a lot about the circuitry and pharmacology of drug addiction. And there are many, many approaches we can take that are much more fruitful than incarcerating every young man that we catch with, between 0 and 2 ounces of marijuana or cocaine.
Now, some of these questions that you're talking about don't really have to do with the fundamentals of our legal system in the sense that we believe in equality before the law. They have to do with things that are just pure corruption, like the privatized prison system and this war on drugs that perpetuates itself because of the flow of money and things like that, and perhaps don't really have that much to do with neuroscience.
Well, I think neuroscience might be the key to offering a better solution. I mean, in the end, the only thing that's going to change the system are not my theoretical arguments about it. It's cost efficacy. And at the end of the day, what we're doing is spending many billions of dollars on a system that's ruining the nation. As you flagged, we have a huge private prison industry. You know, if you make a list of all the really terrible countries in the world that you wouldn't want to be on the same list with, America is number one on that list in terms of the percentage of our population that we're willing to put behind bars. And the thing is, it's just very expensive, and it has collateral consequences that spill out for the rest of people's lives. So if you put a young man in jail for having an ounce of marijuana, then he cannot get a college grant when he gets out. You've broken his employment opportunities. You've also broken his social circles and given him new social circles and new employment opportunities. And sociologists have long shown that prison is criminogenic, which means that it causes more crime, because when you put somebody into prison, by the time they get out, you're now dealing with a new level of somebody who can commit crimes better. So that's the sense in which, I mean, I think the main argument on my part doesn't have to rest on accusations of corruption or anything like that. It's just an issue of cost efficacy. It makes no sense for us to keep spending as much money as we do on a system that has such low utility.
So you write about some kind of striking examples, like there was a fellow named Charles Whitman who in 1966 went on a horrible killing spree. And it turned out that he had a brain tumor, and he was aware that there was something wrong with him. And for all the world, it really kind of sounded like the devil made me do it. And in his case, the devil was a brain tumor.
Well, it is the case that when your biology changes, you change. Your decision-making, the way you act, your personality. And Charles Whitman was a very high IQ young man. He had been an Eagle Scout. He, at this point in his life, was working as a bank teller, and he was an engineering student at the University of Texas at Austin. And he very carefully kept a diary of the last year of his life where he said, I don't really understand myself these days. I'm supposed to be an average, reasonable, and intelligent young man. However, lately I've been a victim of many unusual and irrational thoughts. And he found himself victim to these ideas and thoughts, and eventually he killed his wife and his mother, and the next morning climbed up on the tower at the University of Texas at Austin campus and started shooting people randomly. But the key thing is, in his suicide note that he wrote the night before, he said, when this is all over, I want an autopsy to be performed because I know that something inside of me has been changing. And that's exactly right. They found a brain tumor. Now, it's, of course, we're not able to say that everybody with a brain tumor that's pressing on this particular part of the brain is going to act like Charles Whitman. But were Whitman's actions related to that? Almost certainly yes, because we see this all the time in neuroscience, that when people get damage to their brain, whether it's a stroke or a tumor or sometimes neurodegenerative disorders or traumatic brain injury, when they get damage to the biology that's running under the hood, that changes who they are. It changes their decision-making. There have been hundreds or maybe thousands of cases like this in the literature. And so when we think about our own decision making, we think, well, I'm not the type of person to do XYZ because I use my free will to make terrific decisions, whereas this person over there uses his free will to make evil decisions. The story is more complicated than that, because if you were to get this brain tumor or stroke or traumatic brain injury, then your terrific decision-making would change, and you could make different sorts of decisions.
And same thing happens when people get Alzheimer's disease. Some nasty people become nice, and some nice people become horrible.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, it's a good example. Yeah, it's a good example that a lot of people have had experience with, where they have a loved one, and they think of this loved one as having a, let's say, a soul, and that's that person's essence. But all that you need to witness is changes in somebody's brain, some changes in their neurobiology, to see that their essence is something quite fragile and can become a different essence with different biology. And in fact, for millennia, civilizations have put small molecules in their body, like alcohol or drugs of all sorts, to change their consciousness, to change their decision-making, to change who they are in that moment. So it's not as though this relationship between the biology running under the hood and how we act, it's not as though this is a big surprise, but somehow when it comes to the way we run social policy, we like to imagine that somehow it has nothing to do with the biology. Now, here's what it buys us. Here's what paying attention to the biology buys us, is a capacity to have a forward-looking legal system. So imagine you're a judge, and you might have several different people showing up in front of your bench who have committed exactly the same crime. But what you would see is that one of them did it because he has schizophrenia and he's totally disconnected from reality and didn't understand the nature and consequences of his action. This next guy who comes in front of your bench is a psychopath. He's somebody who doesn't care about you. He can't simulate your emotional state. He's aggressive. He's willing to hurt you. Totally different kind of biology going on and totally different decision-making going on in this guy. The next guy comes up. He committed the crime because he's a drug addict and was tweaked out on cocaine and was doing decisions based on that, and so on and so forth. You'd see lots and lots of different types. The thing that frustrates a lot of judges who are thoughtful about this issue is that often they have mandated sentencing. So for this crime, you have to give 10 years in prison, and yet it's so obvious that these people could be routed different directions through the legal system into the future. Now, the most important thing for a penal system, of course, is to keep society safe. So this doesn't let anybody off the hook. It doesn't say, oh, you poor guy, there's something wrong with your brain, so we forgive you. Instead, what it does is it says, how can we do customized sentencing and tailored rehabilitation? Because the fact is that the population is made up of many different types of people, and a data-driven legal system is one that looks at the person in front of the bench and says, okay, well, what do we do from here? What's the most reasonable thing for us moving forward? Are there rehabilitative strategies that are available? And by that I mean, you know, real strategies that actually work, and those do exist for things like drug addiction and for schizophrenia. At the moment, there are no rehabilitative strategies for psychopaths, also known as sociopaths, and people are researching that, but so far they haven't come up with any good rehabilitative strategies. So, in theory, that person would have to be locked up for longer. But a person who has got schizophrenia, who's suffering from a mental illness, they can, in various cases, be helped with the right medications. People who have drug addiction can certainly be helped.
We're talking to neuroscientist David Eagleman. It's an interesting place that neuroscience is in right now because there's a lot that you know and a lot that you don't know. And there's, I mean, okay, brain injuries and tumors and so on can change behavior, and we've seen that. But you're also anticipating a much more, I think, subtle understanding of brain physiology and brain behavior in the years to come. Do you also anticipate a corresponding subtlety and efficacy in treatment?
Yes, I mean, that's exactly the direction that things have been going. It's impossible to know how far we'll get, but it's clear that we're in the golden era of brain research now. There are so many people in the field now. There's so many new technologies. There's a real push nationally and globally to try to really conquer this final frontier and understand what's happening in there. And I think the sentencing in the future will be predicated on ways that we can work on rehabilitation strategies. I mean, so one thing that people worry about when these conversations start is the minority report scenario where people get punished in advance of doing any sort of crime. That can never happen for several reasons. First of all, it's built into, I mean, it's a tenet of American jurisprudence that you cannot punish somebody before they've committed a crime. But the reason this makes sense, that you can't punish somebody, is because people's behavior depends very much on context. So you can take the exact same brain and put it in several different contexts, and you'll get very different behavior. So just as one example, if you take somebody who's a psychopath, who doesn't care about other people and is willing to hurt other people, you know, in one situation, that person will become a murderer, and that's the type of person we'd want to lock up. But in a different situation, you might put him in a suit and put him on Wall Street, and he becomes a very successful CEO because he has no hesitation about smashing his way to the top, and that kind of person gets handsomely rewarded. Or you might stick him in an NFL uniform and put him on the front line and say, okay, go destroy the other guy, and he'll do fine, and he'll, again, get handsomely rewarded with a high salary. Or you might put him in a military uniform and send him off to war, and he'll be really good at hurting other people. So the point is that the same brain in different contexts may or may not cross some sort of line that society has decided is a line that you can't cross. So it's for reasons like this that we can never punish people before they've committed a crime. But the other important aspect here to consider is that even as our brain science moves forward, the brain is the most complicated device we've ever found in the universe. And people are really, really complicated and nuanced as a result. And context is impossible to predict in advance. So it's not as though we're leading to a place where we could look at somebody's brain and say, ah, this person will become a murderer. It's totally impossible, not only now, but in 1,000 years from now, because the whole world is too complicated. It's, you know, it's millions of ping pong balls pinging into one another, and stuff happens, and people find themselves in different social contexts as a result of that.
Right, but there's also a scenario that we already have today in some ways, that what some people consider a mental disorder in need of medical treatment is by other people considered perfectly normal or even an asset. Like some kids have the need to move around and be very expressive, and some of those are medicated for attention deficit disorder, and others are allowed to do sports or dance or do theater and do things where they can use those traits. And I wonder if you think that there will be a danger that we might, as we learn how to do so, medicate away a lot of human behavior.
It's a great question, but the answer is no. And the reason is, the reason we have such a rich society is because of the individual differences in brains. So you can see this right when you look at a college campus, the kids coming in, some of them are running off to join the Young Democrats, some are joining the Young Republicans, some are going to the accountant classes, some are going to the artist classes, you know, some are playing Dungeons and Dragons, some are going off to the athletic field. People are really different, and that's great. That's exactly how we get a rich society. So I don't think there's any danger of leading to a point where anybody's getting medicated in particular ways to have them be a certain way. The exception to this is when we lay down a legal system, we say, all right, look, we're drawing this line in the sand. You can be any kind of kid you want, but you can't go rape somebody. You can't go murder somebody. And if they cross that societally agreed upon line in the sand, then that's what the penal system is for. But anybody can do whatever they want in this country and in most countries, and you can also dance as close as you want to that line. It's just a matter of crossing the line that are, you know, these lines that are clearly demarcated. So these issues shouldn't be conflated about the richness that we get out of individual variability in society and pre-doing things to people. And in fact, that's why I gave that example about even if you knew that somebody was a psychopath, you can't do anything about it because they haven't crossed the line yet. And so, you know, and depending on the context they find themselves in, they might become high up in some white-collar industry.
Well, but I mean, they already are medicating highly expressive and energetic children.
Well, it depends what the they is, right? I mean, I happen to feel the same way that I'm guessing you do, which is that there's a real over-medication of the problem. But it's just a matter, that's a matter of where local physicians and parents want to draw their own line in the sand. So there is a spectrum. I mean, when you look at something like ADD, kids all the way at one end of that spectrum are really having a real problem. They cannot concentrate. They can't. They're really failing, not because they don't have inherent intelligence, but because they can't lock on and focus to any one thing. And so, if you were a parent of a child like that, you might say, "Okay, well, let's see if there's something we can do." And medication might be one of your options. The problem is that it's a spectrum. It's not two separate categories between
right.
those kids and high-functioning kids who are able to sustain attention. And so what happens is lots and lots of kids in the middle of that spectrum are told, well, you seem to have ADD, and so then the parents have to make the decisions. But look, nobody's forcing any parent to do anything, and no physician is forcing it. That's individual family choice.
We're talking to neuroscientist David Eagleman. There seems to be a difference, and of course it's on a continuum, but between those who act without thinking about their choices, and then they either commit crimes or maybe they just do really stupid things, or and then there's other people who are more deliberative and aware, and they're aware that they're making choices. And these differences are based on certainly both one's basic nature and one's education and culture. Can you see those differences in the brain between a disciplined and an undisciplined person?
Well, in certain cases, yes, it's very obvious. So there's a part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex, which is the area just behind your forehead. And that's really the area that's the engine of socialization and long-term decision-making. It's the most slowly developing part of the brain also. So it doesn't finish getting developed until you're about 20 or 21. And, of course, car insurance companies know this, which is why they charge more for young drivers, and this is why we have an age limit for voting and drinking and military and so on, because kids' brains are just different than adult brains. They haven't yet come into full development. And so it turns out that this prefrontal cortex is the thing that allows you to forego instant impulses. You know, you have some craving for something. It allows you to override that. It's sort of the prefrontal cortex is sort of the brakes for the engine of other parts of the brain. And so what happens is many people can get damage in their prefrontal cortex, and then they're acting just like a child or a teenager again, in terms of they'll urinate in public or take off their clothes in public or flagrantly violate traffic laws or social rules or things like that. And so there's a colleague of mine who describes a particular kind of crime that he calls prefrontal crime. And these are the kind of things where you hear people making fun of some criminal. They say, oh, this criminal was so stupid. He did X, Y, Z, and he didn't even think about it, and he got caught. And the thing is, people laugh at these sorts of stories, but it probably represents, in many of those cases, prefrontal damage to their brain. And the reason they're making what appear to be such silly and unthought-out decisions about how they're going to do this crime is because they don't have the same brain running under the hood that you and I do. They have damage to their frontal lobes.
You write that most of the functioning of the brain is actually below the level of conscious thought. Can you describe that for us so that people know what you mean?
Yeah, it turns out that most of what you think and do and act and believe, it's all generated by parts of your brain that you have no conscious access to. It's running under the hood. And the conscious part of the brain, which is the part of you that flickers to life when you wake up in the morning, that's the smallest bit of what's happening in the brain. It's sort of, you know, it's the broom closet in the mansion of the brain. And so even though we tend to think, oh, yes, I'm this kind of person or that kind of person, all of this stems from deep wiring. And by deep, I mean both in terms of evolutionary time and also in terms of your access to it, things that are driving your decision-making around. I'll just give one example in case it's useful, because I these things are so fascinating, I think. But there was a study done where men were asked to rate the attractiveness of women's faces in photographs. So they rated them from 1 to 10, how attractive they thought the woman was. And what the men didn't know is that in half of the photographs, the women's eyes had been dilated with some eye drops. So the men uniformly found the women with the dilated eyes to be more attractive. But none of the men were able to consciously notice that the women's eyes were bigger in some of the photographs than others. And presumably none of the men knew that dilated eyes is a sign of sexual readiness in women. But their brains knew it. It picked up on that right away, and it drove their behavior appropriately. And, of course, love always goes this way, right? You find yourself more attracted to some people than others. You don't know why. I mean, look, before you go through puberty, you're not even that interested in the opposite sex. And then all of a sudden, your brain gets washed with a different cocktail of hormones, and suddenly you're obsessed with it. So, you know, it's obvious that there are programs that are getting unpacked at different times in our brains that represent deep subroutines that drive our behavior and our decision-making around.
And then it's interesting, too, once you learn that, okay, you've told us that, and now everybody who's listening to this radio broadcast right now knows that, and so they will become more aware of it. And a lot of the teachings that we have in our society, and for, you know, teachings like Buddhist meditation, they're about increasing awareness. And there seems to be a connection between conscious awareness, like the example you just gave, and the experience of freedom and the sense of free choice. And I wondered if you could talk about that, the connection between conscious awareness and that sense of freedom and free will.
Yeah, well, I can tell you this. We don't have the killer experiment in neuroscience currently to know whether or not we have free will. So a lot of neuroscientists land on the side that we probably don't have free will. And the reason they think that is because when you look in the brain, even though it's so complicated, fundamentally, it's a biological machine. Everything is driving everything else, and so it's not clear where you can sort of slip in the ghost in the machine of free will. And it's not even really clear what it would mean to say, I'm going to make a decision that's completely independent of all my history. So it's not clear whether we have free will. I'm personally not so certain that we don't. It may be that our science is still too young to even know how to ask the question correctly. But what does seem really clear at this point, after hundreds of years of neuroscience study, is that if we have free will at all, it's a very small player in the system. In other words, although you think, oh, yes, I can steer the boat and do whatever I want, I could make any sort of decision I want, it's not that easy. You can't take somebody like Jeffrey Dahmer, the serial murderer, and have him use his free will to act just like you. Nor can you use your free will to go and act like him. Why? Because you're totally different than him, neurally speaking. You can't stand in his shoes. And, you know, if for anyone who doesn't believe this, just try using your free will right now to change your sexual orientation. So whatever it is, just go ahead and switch it over to the other side. Good luck, right? Because we're biological creatures, and you are programmed up to operate a particular way, and free will is really, really limited.
If we move from a concept of free will and responsibility to one more like, you know, our behavior is largely a result of under-the-hood brain physiology, could this not engender a society of ever less responsible people?
Well, the key is this. The responsibility question, I think, doesn't matter for the legal system. So, in other words, when you look at somebody who, I mean, I don't know, take John Hinckley, who shot President Reagan because he was deeply schizophrenic and believed that Jodie Foster would love him if he did this act. Now, the question of was John Hinckley responsible for having schizophrenia is sort of a non-issue, right? I mean, blameworthiness in that case is not exactly the right question to be asking. So my argument is, all we need to be doing as a legal system is asking, what do we do from here? We want a forward-looking legal system rather than a backwards-looking one. A backwards-looking one, which we currently have, is all about retribution and punishment, which, by the way, we are very hardwired for. We want, I mean, all of us have bloodlust. We want, when somebody breaks the rules, we want to see them hurt. But the fact is, it's not a terribly efficient system. It's very cost ineffective, and it's really out of control in this country where we have so many millions in jail.
Well, hang on a second. I mean, I think that if you look at who wants and doesn't want bloodlust, that's also a cultural thing, and there's different kinds of people perhaps with different kinds of brains. I mean, if you look at Quakers and Unitarians and psychotherapists, they generally don't feel that way.
Well, you're absolutely right. And one of the things we study is jury decision making, and we look at what things trigger retributive impulses, why some jurors are capable of more utilitarianism, or others are more drawn towards retributivism. So you're totally right about that. But probably even for the most peaceful soul among us, when you see something like the bombing at the Boston Marathon or hundreds of other events that you can see in the news every day, even the most peaceful souls feel some drive, some tweak, they might be able to override it, where they feel like that was really wrong to kill innocent people. Punishment is a really important part of what we do. And there have been neuroimaging studies showing how satisfying it is to people to see a rule breaker get punished. Now, I think the point you're making is not everybody feels that way, and I totally agree with that. But enough people feel that way, probably a majority, that those individual differences aren't enough to change the retributive system that we have. And by the way, I'm not opposed to retribution personally. I think, you know, in some cases it's appropriate and so on. And I'm not opposed to incarceration, just for the record. In many cases, incarceration is the original rehabilitative strategy, where you put somebody in a prison and they think, wow, this is so terrible, I don't ever want to be back here again. And if they get out and they walk a straight line, then that's exactly what we wanted out of it.
But that's the mythology. But as you said before, the reality is that prisons engender more crime.
Yeah, on average, they engender more crime. That's exactly right. The problem is that we treat incarceration as a one-size-fits-all. And what we get as a result of that are really, we throw everybody in there instead of asking who could benefit from it and who is absolutely not going to benefit from it and who's not going to benefit in being in the same ward as somebody else. And as a result, if you take somebody with, let's say, schizophrenia, and you have them break rocks in the hot sun all summer, that does nothing to solve the problem.
Now, would you say that most people who have committed horrible crimes are mentally ill?
No. So mental illness from a legal point of view has a very specific definition, and that is you have to have something like a psychosis, which is essentially a disconnection from reality. So people with schizophrenia, if you see a homeless person on the street who's talking to himself and having a conversation and maybe is paranoid and deluded, that's a psychosis, and that counts, that qualifies for the insanity defense. So from the point of view of the legal system, that's what a mental illness is, and that makes up, I don't know off the top of my head the fraction, but that makes up a minority of what happens in the prison population. Now, that's from the legal definition of mental illness. There are lots of other things that people do that you and I might look at and say, my gosh, how could any normal person do that? And it's true that there's something very different about the operation of that person's brain. It's just definitionally that doesn't count as a mental illness. For example, psychopathy, somebody who's a psychopath, that doesn't count as a mental illness. I mean, one might argue that it should or something, but just from a definitional point of view, it's not that.
So what does punishment do to the brain from your perspective as a neuroscientist? And what do its opposite, like what do love and kindness and things like that do to the brain of somebody who is incarcerated or who needs help?
You know, the fact is, it's a great question you're asking, but all these things really depend so much on the individual. So there is no one-size-fits-all solution, including giving people lots of love and kindness, because, you know, if you try doing that to Jeffrey Dahmer or Ted Bundy, it's not going to work. Let me give you an example of this, in fact. People have long been interested in the question of, can we find rehabilitative strategies for people who are psychopaths? And one of the things that was tried was putting people with psychopathy in group therapy while they're in prison, putting them in group therapy with non-psychopaths so they can really talk and hear other people's feelings and hear how things make other people feel. And then they tracked these guys after releasing them from prison and found out that they had a higher recidivism rate. In other words, they were more likely to reoffend, and it's because by sitting in group therapy, they were just listening carefully, and they thought, oh, I didn't know that if I say this, that makes somebody feel like that. And they just got better and better at playing the chess game of manipulating other people's feelings. Because for people with high levels of psychopathy, they just don't care about you. And so treating them with love and kindness isn't actually a solution. So your question is well taken, but it really depends on the individual.
What kinds of rehabilitation are you working on?
Well, one of the things we're doing in my lab is with drug addiction. So we're using what's called real-time feedback in neuroimaging, brain imaging, to try to help people who are addicted to, let's say, cocaine. They've tried to quit, but they found themselves unable. We're working with really cutting-edge technology to see if we can help people strengthen their own long-term decision-making so that they'll still have just as big a craving for cocaine. But the question is, can they override it? Can they say, you know what? I know how to use my prefrontal cortex to override this craving. And so the idea is, it's totally participatory. In other words, it won't work unless you're trying to strengthen your long-term decision-making. And we're just at the foot of the mountain on this experiment. We're really in the very earliest stages. But within a year, we will know if this works. And if it does, that allows us as neuroscientists to go to the legal system and say, you know what? Instead of incarcerating all these young guys who are drug addicts, why don't you at least give them something like a deferred adjudication predicated on maintaining a clean urinalysis after going through this training paradigm? And something like this will probably cost $500. Compare that to the cost of $40,000 a year of incarcerating somebody, plus all of the collateral consequences that spill out for the rest of their lives.
Now, in this paradigm, do you expect that the craving and the addiction will eventually decrease?
Not necessarily. We don't know the answer to that. It's simply the case that people will have the cognitive tools to override that craving. So I don't know. Maybe their conscious awareness of the craving will decrease. I'm not certain. But it's not even necessary for this to work. All it is that somebody might feel like, wow, you know, I really want that, but I know what it takes to resist it. Just, you know, imagine what it would be like with chocolate cake or something if you said, wow, that really looks like a delicious piece, but I've really trained myself up to know how to use my willpower to resist eating that.
We're talking to neuroscientist David Eagleman. So you will be here in Santa Fe on Tuesday, the 4th of June, talking about the brain and the law, how neuroscience will shift blameworthiness. And as you say, it's not about letting people go or letting them off the hook, but understanding people better who've committed crimes, which seems to me will also, if we go that direction as a society, help us understand our own selves better as well.
Well, yes, and of course, 90% of what I do in my neuroscience laboratory is about understanding our own selves, you know, trying to figure out what we're made out of and who we are. Yeah, and you know, and the key about, just to cap that last thing off about understanding criminals better, it's not understanding them better in order to, you know, to sort of understand what's happening inside their heads and have an increased sense of forgiveness, because that's not really the issue. It's just, how do we root people forward in the legal system and say, okay, this person can get the most rehabilitation and the most efficacious treatment going this way to, let's say, a mental institution because he's got schizophrenia. This person has a high level of psychopathy, and you know, a mental institution is not going to help this person. This guy over here is tweaked out on drugs and was doing this crime because he's feeding his drug addiction, and we know how to help him break that drug addiction and so on. And as you go down the list, you can, you know, you see different ways of moving people forward through the legal system that just has a lot higher utility and efficiency.
David Eagleman is a neuroscientist, author, and director of the Laboratory for Perception and Action at Baylor College of Medicine, where he also directs the Initiative on Neuroscience and Law. And once again, he will be in Santa Fe on Tuesday, the 4th of June at 7:30 in the evening, giving a talk called The Brain and the Law, How Neuroscience Will Shift Blameworthiness. It's at the James A. Little Theater, and it's sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. The Santa Fe Institute is on the web at santafe.edu. David Eagleman, thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Hershey Felder. He's creator of the one-man show Maestro, The Art of Leonard Bernstein, which is at the Lenzik Performing Arts Center this Friday, May 31st through Sunday, June 2nd. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. I think I did this a number of years ago when I came to the Lenzik for Gershwin.
Oh, okay.
And I remember sitting in a cafe. I don't know if you did it, but I think I sat with somebody over some really, really, really effervescent cinnamon buns.
Yes, this was, in fact, the place.
That was the place. Okay, so I know. Yeah, wonderful.
Oh, good. Well, welcome back. So let's talk about the type of performance you do. I mean, you've done Gershwin and Chopin and Beethoven. Did you always know that you wanted to do Leonard Bernstein?
Actually, not at all. It was one of the characters that a lot of people brought to me, and different theater directors and public, they kept on saying, well, you've done all these characters. You'd be such a perfect fit for Bernstein. You look a little bit like him, which I really don't, and you act like him, which I don't at all, and you like the things that he liked, which, you know, as far as music, absolutely. Everything else, not so much. But I couldn't quite figure out how I could make that character come to life. And it took a number of, at least 10 years until I really figured it out, because I was busy doing the other things. And then people asked me to do it, you know, different theater directors. And I said, well, I'll give it a shot, sort of as a joke. And turns out it became the one that the public and the critics liked the best. So, you know, why not? You never know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things I was trying to imagine the process of immersion and selection that you had to go through in creating this performance. I mean, Bernstein's life and accomplishments were so vast and varied.
Well, you know, the way these things work is to find a through line and a point at the beginning. And sometimes a point doesn't quite reveal itself at the beginning, but you got to at least guide yourself toward finding some story to tell. And that was the biggest question with this, is what story could I tell, and was there a story to tell? And would it mean anything? And looking at his life, I found a number of things that were really very interesting and intriguing. A lot of contradictions in terms, you know, you had somebody who wanted to be on Broadway. It was a great conductor and serious music. You had somebody who was a great conductor but wanted to be a composer. You had a man who was for the public, you know, the perfect father and the wonderful family man, but was really interested in a homosexual lifestyle. or actually lived one to some degree. And so you had all kinds of contradictions in this guy, and it turns out that's what the public really likes. And it makes for a very good story. And, you know, people ask me, well, the others are all dead, so of course they're easy to portray. And, you know, here you have a guy who's only died 20 years ago, or 23 years ago. So how could you very possibly do him? It's too soon. People remember him. How could you pull it off? And it turns out it's made it easier because people have points of reference that are contemporary. And that always makes a lot of the explaining so much easier. If I do one of the older characters, I have to start at the very beginning with my points of reference and set up my context, which takes a whole lot longer. This I can dive right into. I'm talking about World War II, or I'm talking about Carnegie Hall in New York, or whatever it is, or whatever situation I'm talking about. He's right there with them. It makes it far more immediate, and I think the public likes that kind of thing. It's fun. You know, they have a good time.
Now, when you're on stage, are you speaking as Leonard Bernstein looking back over his life, or is it a certain point in his life?
Well, it is a certain point, but it isn't just looking back. It's a certain point, you know, just before it's sort of over for him, and he has a number of very big questions with the whole thing. So I think that is, you know, it's not just like a sort of a memory play, oh, and this happened and that happened. Something is happening to him, and it causes a big problem for him. And that's what sort of leads us in the direction that we're going with this piece. And again, it makes it immediate because we're dealing with a problem that's quite immediate.
I think people like Leonard Bernstein, at least for me, are inspirations on many levels. And one of them is the boldness with which he asked questions about his life and was able to have doubts and express them and to be curious and explore and not kind of have a facade that he showed to the public where you didn't see his real self. I wondered if he was an inspiration to you as a human being as well as a composer and performer and so on.
Well, no. I mean, you know, I find him complicated. You know, he's certainly not an inspiration as a human being, but what is inspirational is the commitment he had to arts and to music and what he really believed and how one should live as an artist in terms of one's study and knowledge. And, you know, it's a complete living for art. And I'm fascinated with that. In terms of his personal life, it's not that he lived with a facade. He lived in front of the public. I mean, he lived out his entire life in front of the public since he was very young and got so much attention, you know, having had that miraculous event happen when he was 25 and he suddenly conducted the New York Philharmonic. I mean, it's an astonishing thing that happened, you know. So becoming that famous, I think he had no choice but to live his life in front of the public, but also that means that wasn't always lived out in such a classy way, because not only would we get the clean laundry, but we got the dirty laundry too, which again makes it fascinating for people watching and listening. But by the same token, it's, you know, he was complicated that way. It was very public, everything that he did.
Now, did you know him? Did you ever see him in real life?
Well, know him, as you know, is very relative. I knew of him. I was 20 when he died. I had met him at the end of his life. I knew all the people around him because I was a part of that circle, and later came in contact with people who were very close with him and knew him very well. If you're a musician in the 21st century, in the late 20th century, you could not know somehow Leonard Bernstein, and you could not be influenced by him. You could not be influenced by him, is what I'm saying. And he, of course, all of us American musicians owe what we have to him. I mean, he was the one who he was the first American of that caliber to rise to such international fame. And the American music scene owes pretty much all of itself to Leonard Bernstein and his sense of creating that here in America, that European tradition here in America in the wholly American way. And without him, I don't think the kind of career that I have now would even exist or even have a hope of existing. So whether I knew him or not is less relevant to the fact that all of us, we all owe him a great, debt of gratitude for doing what he did.
We're talking to Hershey Felder about the one-man show Maestro, The Art of Leonard Bernstein. How long have you been doing this performance?
This particular one started in summer of 2010, and I think it's probably had 400 or 500 performances since, something like that. It's a lot.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
a lot of performances. You know, I mean, Gershwin has had over 3,000, so, you know. I mean, I have ways to go, but, again, this one started just a couple years back, so it's now on its journey, which is kind of nice to see it happening.
Has the show changed or developed in some ways since you started doing it?
Well, I think these things are always, you know, they shouldn't ever be stagnant, because the moment they're stagnant, you know, it becomes dead theater as opposed to live theater. And it's not that they change as much as that I just know him better. And, you know, of course, some of the writing over time does change, some of it significantly, a lot of it not. But this was one of them, of all the pieces that I worked on, you know, the Chopin, Beethoven, whatever, this is the one that changed the least in terms of its text from its first performances to now. How it changed was in my comfort and understanding of who the character is. But somehow the story always worked very well from the very beginning.
You have, I don't know if you think so, I mean, you were saying at the beginning that you didn't, but it seems like you have quite a lot in common with Leonard Bernstein in the sense that you were both born in North America to Eastern European Jewish parents. You're both composers and pianists and performers. Do you take that common, well, I mean, do you see that? Do you take that into your performance?
Well, no, because, I mean, I only do what I do because I do it. I don't view it as a comparison. I mean, you know, I'm not enough hubris to sort of think that, well, now that I do all the same things that Leonard Bernstein does, well, I'm like Leonard Bernstein. Of course I'm not. And, you know, I mean, he really was a genius. He was a spectacular artist. And I just do what I do. And it happens to be all the same. But he wasn't an actor. He didn't do that, you know. And he wasn't that kind of writer in theatrical terms that I've been doing, and so what I do is quite a bit different. Yet at the same time, because I do what I do, I recognize things about his character that make it easier or perhaps more affecting when I'm doing that character on the stage, because I understand some of the things he did. I don't have to learn about them or put them on and sort of paste it on face. I understand it.
Now, with one-man shows, sometimes the audience can forget that you have a director, that it's actually a collaboration, although we don't see the other person. What is the nature of the collaboration with your director?
Usually editing. It's a lot of, you know, because you have a man and a piano and several props on stage, you can't go very far, you know. It's stage right, stage left, down stage center, up stage, and then sit at the piano when all else fails. So, I mean, there's very little you can do. So that way, that's the way that works. You know, it's a little bit of traffic cop. But after that, it's really the editing that's the important part, you know. One can be as florid creatively as possible. And, you know, then the editor, the great director, has to come in and say, that's good, that's not, that's good, put this here, put that there. Let me show you how to clean this up. Let me make it clear. That's what a director does, and my director does for this particular piece anyway, or these set of pieces anyway. It's more about the editing of the material, the action, and the stagecraft so that it really blends into a piece all its own, you know? And I think that's the most important thing is clarity. And I've had good fortune to have a director with great sense of clarity. And the wonderful thing about Joel Zwick is that he's the world's greatest audience. And, you know, he can sit and watch a piece of theater 1,000 times and he still laughs if it's the first time. But because he's such a good audience and so aware of how good he is, what ends up happening is he doesn't lead audiences astray with big directorial flourishes. He just wants to tell a really good story and wants the public to enjoy.
Hershey Felder is the creator of the one-man show Maestro, The Art of Leonard Bernstein, which is at the Lenzik Friday, Saturday, and Sunday of this week. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure speaking with you.